we have to be at least conscious of the fact that readers have multiple demands on their time and their attention, and they're perhaps not reading us in the way that they used to read The Atlantic. You know, readers don't read us to catch up on what happened last night, overnight. You know, they don't read us to see, you know, to hear what just happened in the Trump press conference or the, you know, the Daily British press conference. They're reading us for depth, for nuance, for context.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Media Voices, the revamped podcast that takes a look at all the news and the views from around the media world. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
So that quote you just heard is from Prashant Rao, who is the global editor at The Atlantic, and we talked about his role in bringing The Atlantic to a global audience, the importance of diversity in writing stories for that audience, and what the global Atlantic angle on coronavirus looks like. We also touched on The Atlantic's surge in subscriptions following its decision, which we've argued about on this before, to take down its paywall on COVID coverage, and why he sees this publication as a second subscription.
See, that's fascinating, and that actually is a really good counterpart to what we're going to be talking about during the news roundup, which is primarily going to be about subscriptions during the coronavirus crisis. And you're right, we've spoken about this loads of times before, but this time we're going to do a bit of a deep dive into it as well. So first off, The Guardian has reported a surge in reader support over the past year. Obviously, this doesn't necessarily include kind of only the coronavirus period. 821,000 people are now making financial contributions, up a quarter on last year. Now, is that not regular contributions?
It's not all regular contributions. I thought
it was 600,000 regular contributions last April or May, and they're now up to 821 regular, because it's 1.16 million including the irregular.
Which
is a bit of a shift in the proportion of people who were, because last time, you remember, even last year we were talking about how do you break this out, and I think we were sort of going around on a sort of 50-50 split on who's, you know, making regular versus one-off contributions.
So this is why I got confused, other than I'm just generally confused. it's now across three or four different products, right? Mm-hmm. You've got the subscriptions, digital subscriptions, you've got the premium subscriptions, you've got the daily app, and you've got puzzle apps. So they're taking that money in from more sources now.
I really just want to know how many people have clicked through those like yellow and blue bars. That's all I want to know.
Half the regular contributors are now coming from people who exist beyond the bounds of the United Kingdom, if you can even remember such places exist.
Yeah, it's Australia, the US and Europe.
Okay. Yeah, which makes sense. English language territories. And what's, I think, crucial about this is that Kath Viner has said that support from readers has grown at record rates during the past 2 months, which is in line with what we've been seeing across sort of actual hard paywalled and metered paywalled subscription models.
There was a thing about how trusted The Guardian was, actually. And The Guardian's one of the most trusted sources internationally for coronavirus news. So I think that's probably playing into it.
I mean, the other thing I think is nice is that, you know, despite the fact that a lot of people are now under financial pressure, I know there was a huge concern at the start of this that would consumers cut back on sort of unessential subscriptions. Actually, that doesn't seem to be happening, which is really encouraging.
Yeah, though you do have to take that with a pinch of salt, because if you look at the spending on other subscription-based products around entertainment, there is still a lot of disposable income out there, and people are seeing, you know, entertainment is more relevant and more important to them. It makes me hopeful that there are so many people who have taken a look and decided that one of the essential things they need during this is accurate information, and they're willing to provide, pay to provide that to other people as well.
Yes, but... Well, no, they absolutely. And they're still, I guess, they're still profitable, or there's definitely the finances are in better shape. However, the paper still had to follow non-editorial staff and cut the cost by about 10 million quid. Mm-hmm. So they're not sailing through this with all these 800,000 people. There's still just a fight. They've still got a fight on their hands.
There are very few who are sailing through, to be
fair.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, there are a couple of notable, you know, exceptions of people who've said, we're not furloughing any members of staff. You know what? Let's just take a step back and say that even 2-3 years ago, The Guardian would have been so exposed to this in a way that they are not now, because they have diversified into memberships.
A very considered summation.
But they're not the only ones who've been seeing success and people actually choosing to support them, because magazine subscriptions have boomed. So Esther, why don't you sort of explain some of those figures?
I will more than happily explain some of these figures, because we had this argument a couple of weeks ago. And Peter, I distinctly remember you saying that you didn't think this would happen and you would love to be proved wrong. So here you go.
That's not true. You were talking about newsstand sales. These are online sales. Ah. These are subscriptions.
Okay. So UK magazine publishers are reporting triple-digit surges in new print and digital subscriptions. I was a little bit confused about the story this came from, because Jellyfish, who I think do digital mag sub, said that they'd seen a huge uptick. But they also said that they'd seen interest in print subscriptions rise by at least twice since the start of the lockdown. I don't know how is that measured. I couldn't find out how that was measured.
Well, it's traffic on... This is what's weird about this story. Okay, before we go any further on this, if this is true, I'm delighted. I want loads of people to buy loads more magazine subscriptions. Do it. But this was about traffic measured to subscription web pages on magazine.co.uk. So that doesn't mean that anyone was actually buying these subscriptions. It just means that they were actually going to see what it costs and see if they could get it. This story is confusing.
Okay, I would also just say anecdotally, I was in Tesco yesterday in a huge queue, and by the time I actually got in, for the first time I thought, I'll go and see if there's any like books or anything I can pick up. The magazine stand was almost empty, and I don't think that's just
Tesco
coming back.
That doesn't mean people was buying it. Of course it does. Whoa, Esther.
I think people are going in and they're like, do you know what? I'm quite bored. I'm going to pick up a magazine.
No, people are going in and they're going, Jesus Christ, there's no magazines on that shelf because Tesco's cut back what it's ordering.
Am I right in thinking that a lot of distributors have just stopped during this? They paused it. I know that that's true for Diamond Distribution in the US. That's specifically for comics, though. I'm not sure if that's...
I don't know if they stopped, but I know I've heard people saying that they've cut back what they're ordering. So if they used to take 25 copies to one particular supermarket, they're now taking 5 or whatever.
But I suppose this is what's then going to be interesting, is if the consumer demand goes up, are they going to reverse that decision? And we're still too early for that. We're still too early to really see what the physical shakeout of this is going to be.
I love your optimism on this. It's brilliant.
I know, I'm like the starry-eyed child on this now.
I know.
Esther, can you just break down some of where that increased interest is coming from by sector?
Yeah, so this is just the interest, as people said, people hovering over the subscribe button online. Kids have seen an incredible 502% increase in interest. Mm. Home and gardening is up 403%, and women's is up 325%. And I know that the Week Junior, who launched in the US, their print, they said that they'd actually seen it had far surpassed expectations, the subscriptions they got. Because parents are sitting at home, their kids are climbing the walls, and if a magazine will shut them up for 20 minutes, they're hitting the buy button.
Yeah, definitely. And also, so let me walk this backwards a little bit. I have heard like magazines like Positive News, Sean Dagan Wood's title, I've seen big increase in subscriptions. Malk Alka, who we had on from the Mountain Bike magazine, he basically said to his subscribers or the guys that are on his website, look, we're in trouble here, help us out. And he saw a real uptick. So I think there's a bunch of stuff going on that's great. I'm not like totally heartless and cynical here, but I do think we need to be realistic. I think the stylist story, the idea that stylists pivoted to digital subscriptions because they can't distribute on the streets anymore. And Esther talked about this a couple of weeks ago, how excited she was to see that app.
I've got the app.
And is it good? So there's the point. Is it a good experience?
It is actually. It's really clean. It's really good. And actually, interestingly, so you can pick stylists up for free on the street, but the app actually, it's $21.99 a year, which when I've stop scabbing my free issues, I will pay. And like this is the first time I'm paying for like a digital subscription to a magazine
or a TV license.
So what is it about the app itself, the experience, that's made you gone, you know, actually I do need to pay to subscribe to this, other than the fact that you will have to?
You know, it's not the app, it's the fact that I built up such a loyalty to stylists when I was in London. I would take a detour to go and pick up the magazine on a Wednesday because it was so good. And it was one of the, it was actually one of the biggest wrenches about moving is I wouldn't be able to pick up stylist anymore. So actually coronavirus in that sense, as horrible as it is, it's actually forced the publisher to reach people like me who now can't pick it up anymore. I was actually thinking like, how am I going to get it? Because where I live now is not anywhere near a distribution point. And yeah, that's 21 quid a year that they wouldn't have got from me otherwise, because there wouldn't have been a product to reach me. So I'm really pleased that they've done this at the time they have, and it just happens to coincide with me moving.
But this is something that has been forced on them, really, hasn't it? Because they did have to bring forward that launch by about 3 months.
Yeah, I mean the thing that I read about this is that the MD Owen Wyatt was she said that they were always looking at reader revenue, consumer revenue for the magazine digitally. But the fact that the ad market and the word that they, I think it was digital, used was decimated by the coronavirus has actually brought it forward by about 3 months, yeah.
You know what? Decimated there is actually an understatement, because, it, you know, decimation is, what, reduction by 1 in 10 is significantly more than that.
Get you geeking out.
What, it is?
I know, it just sounds so much worse. Decimation sounds like annihilation.
Yeah, it does. In fact, annihilation is probably a better term for this, because it was, in terms of what, print newspapers, up to 60% in some cases. Fuck. Just insane.
Well, there's this, so the other side of this shift to digital membership thing or consumer revenue thing is what the Daily Beast doing on their membership and how they've changed that around, and the idea that the value of their programmatic has dropped by 40%. So if they can sell ads, what they're getting for it is 40% down on what they were asking. And again, they've moved plans forward early, or they've ramped up plans to get more serious on memberships.
They've seen some success with that though, haven't they?
Yeah, they've done. I mean, it's like the numbers I saw was 100% up comparing the first 3 months of the year. So they're double over 2 months what they had in 3 months.
What are they attributing that to? Because that's far and above beyond the growth you'd expect to see.
Well, they've taken your strategy, Christopher, and moved all their health and wellness and coronavirus content in front of the paywall. Also, they've introduced a bunch of trials, but part of that trial is they've got this... this is clever shit. They've got this give us more option. So if your subscription is, I don't know what it is for the Beast Inside, but say it's $40 a year or $50 a year, they've got to give us $100 option. Support us, help us get through this. You need really good content now. We're giving you really good content. Give us $100 rather than whatever the normal subscription.
But their trial is really cheap. It's like $1.
Yeah, but that's just the starting point. That's a... Candyman idea, isn't it? they've reported that their overall order value is up 35%, and that, I'm sure if they're doing these dollar trials, then that can only be because people are saying, I really value this, I'm going to give you more than you've asked for.
I mean, that was the whole thing that the correspondence model was predicated on, wasn't it? It was, yeah. Oh no, the correspondent. It was like a pay what you want for membership and just help us launch.
That's right.
Well, you know who else is doing something interesting with subscriptions is the Financial Times. They're almost selling a subscription, because its consulting arm FT Strategies is now running this 9-month project to help grow sustainable digital reader revenue in concert with 8 other European subscription publishers. So it's as part of the Google News Initiative, so it's part funded by Google, and there's a vast raft of publishers from all the way across Europe, which actually I think really helps to mitigate this issue that we have with English language subscription products really tilting the scales a little bit when we talk about them.
Has that been launched specifically because of the coronavirus crisis, or
no,
is that
no. I think it was part of the Google News Initiative subscription.
Okay. And moving on now to news in brief, and publishers are looking to cheap Facebook ads to actually increase subscriptions. So this is from Digiday, from Max Willens, and the headline is "Get While the Getting's Good." And so it's basically a really good explainer of how publishers are looking to Facebook ads to help drive subscriptions.
Sorry, is this because the price of Facebook ads has crashed?
Yeah, I'm going to quote from the article. It says, in the first half of April, the cost of acquiring a newsletter subscriber through Facebook fell from 75 cents to 25 cents, thanks to a combo of lower CPMs and significantly higher click-through rates.
Good to see the ad crash benefiting somebody. And this is going to be a tough one for me to fit into news, a nib item, but the leaked images by TechCrunch have revealed that Google has actually designed a feature that would essentially enable micropayments for publishers. But they scrapped the idea and chose not to build the product. So it's Google essentially made their own like Guardian banner that meant that you could donate to publishers or whatever site you were on, which, in my humble opinion, is exactly what would solve the entire issue of micropayments, but they've scrapped it. So
on a scale of one to f***ing furious, where you are?
I'm definitely at the top end of that.
Yay. Insane. You know, the problem with micropayments is that you need that kind of critical mass of publishers doing it. This would have solved it like that.
Do you know, it would have either been Google or Facebook that put this in place to do it, and to know Google got that close, I think they're the lesser of two evils, so it's just a little bit frustrating.
So the New York Times morning email newsletter is getting an official host and anchor. And what's interesting about this is they're taking some of the lessons learned from the Daily Podcast, which is like an insane success.
Yeah,
I'm trying
really
to take it across to this newsletter. So the morning briefing will be hosted by David Leonard, who is an opinion columnist. I just think the parallels between the Daily Podcast and this newsletter are really interesting. I think there's a lot of publishers going to be starting looking at the different lessons that they can learn from these different formats.
Yeah, it wasn't even too long ago where a lot of publishers, I think the NYT was doing it as well, were sort of like downplaying the value of individual journalists.
Yeah.
Now it's just like you're going to host everything. Moving on, you might remember that 6 months ago, a short 6 months, we celebrated the fact that Mike Suter, previous guest on Media Voices, had taken over as chief exec of the Evening Standard. Well, he's now stepping down. The Press Gazette article we're taking this from has said during the pandemic. And he said, "In the last few weeks, I've taken time to reflect on my own ambitions and plans, and it is on that basis that I have made the decision to step away to pursue other business interests."
In related news, I saw him on Question Time the other night.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I turned it over immediately, but I did see him on there.
On to some better news. So VAT was scrapped on digital publications. That was supposed to be coming into force very early next year. That has now actually been fast-tracked, and as of yesterday, it's just been completely scrapped. So Rishi Sunak has said that that's basically because people are sitting at home, not doing anything, and looking to read magazines and books. they have fast-tracked their plans to scrap it so that it'll make it basically cheaper for publishers to get their stuff there. So that's just like a bit of relief while they can give it.
I saw The Guardian's media editor, Jim Waterson, saying it's the big question is whether the saving is passed on to consumers. Is it going to be passed on to consumers?
Yeah, no chance. In not so good news, DC Thompson is closing the weekly news on its 165th anniversary, man. So the weekly news was like a weekly newspaper that came out on a Wednesday, I think. And I, believe it or not 165 years ago, used to deliver it on my paper run. I'm sad. I'm really sad.
And also in bad news, I'm going to read directly from the article here, which we're taking from the Daily Maverick. It says, "An empire comes to an end as Associated Media Publishing closes its doors." So it's the largest distributor of print media in South Africa?
Certainly pretty significant, well, yeah. They did sort of Cosmo and...
Yeah, they did a lot of stuff under license from Condé and stuff.
And as the article says, it's the end of an almost four-decade era. And they're attributing it almost solely to the coronavirus.
Yeah, Julia Raffley was... I'm probably saying her name wrong, but she's been a good friend to us, so we're pretty sad about that.
Slightly better news. The Washington Post has got a great story about some of the kids making newspapers during the coronavirus crisis. So we'll include a link to that, but their front pages and stuff are just absolutely adorable.
Yay. I love an adorable front page. And finally, a story for our times. The FT is suspended. Journalist accused of listening to rival paper's Zoom calls. Chris, you got to explain this story to me.
All right. Okay.
How did he even get into these Zoom calls?
It's not as difficult as you might think. In fact, didn't you link me to somebody who said basically you should be considering your Zoom calls
public domain? Yeah, but that's a view based on the security. But how do you? I'm asking for a friend. How do you actually do it?
All you need is the link, And you need, in some cases, a password. But the reaction on media Twitter has been immediate and very, very disparate. People have been saying, this is hugely unethical. You know, regardless of what you think of the man himself, this is
It is hugely unethical.
But do we think that there would have been this furore? Would he have been asked to resign had he done it to another industry? If he listened into a Zoom call in, say, the aviation sector, and report use that information to then report, would that have been considered as bad?
Well, there's a definite hypocrisy coming from an industry that at certain points was involved in phone hacking. certain corners of our industry. But no, it's unethical. It doesn't matter how you look at it. So to be listening in to the standards calls about following people is kind of shitty. And then
that resignation has come from him personally, though. It's there's not been any real statement from the FT or anything about the situation yet, so it'll be interesting to see how that falls out next week.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the meantime, I'm going to stop listening in on Media Masters Zoom calls.
So this week I spoke with The Atlantic's global editor, Prashant Rao, and I began by asking him what he's been working on at the publication since they announced their global expansion and brought him on board a few years ago.
There are a lot of things I had to learn, right, to begin with. I think one of the things about The Atlantic is, you know, I think moving from one news organization to another is always a bit of a culture shock because, you know, different news organizations have different values, they have different goals. And also, they have different styles. So I think moving from one newspaper to the next may not be as difficult, but to move from an organization like the New York Times, which is a daily newspaper, or a Newswire, where I'd worked previously, to, and of course, the New York Times is more than a daily newspaper now, to a place like The Atlantic, it is a bit of a jolt. So I think that took me some time to adjust to the cadence, but also the mindset of what is an Atlantic story. So I spent a lot of time early on kind of thinking about what is our focus, you know, what should we be covering, how should we be writing about it, thinking very deliberately about what is an Atlantic story, and so then what do we do that, for example, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Guardian, the Financial Times, the Washington Post, that others don't do. So that I spent a lot of time doing that. And then, you know, as we got a little more comfortable with that, and I think, you know, this is still a learning process. I've only been at The Atlantic for about 18 months. I think then we had to move on to sort of hiring and thinking about expanding our freelance network and what is it we're looking for from freelancers. And then, you know, concurrently all through that, we're trying to get a sense of who our readers are, what do they want from us. And this is, you know, I don't think any of these is like step one, then step two, then step three. I think you kind of try to do all of them to some degree concurrently, which may slow down a lot of it at once, but that is in any case what we decided to do. So yeah, that's been the general kind of thing that I've been doing, at least.
And what does that Atlantic story look like on a global stage? You know, how do you decide what to focus the global coverage on? Because I mean, like, global is massive.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think, again, I reflexively, of course, as everyone does, I contrast it with my own experience, right? So if I compare to being at a Newswire and then being at the Times, you know, there is something, I mean, obligation is the wrong word, but people go to those news organizations for something very different than what they come to The Atlantic for. They're coming to catch up. They're coming to prepare in terms of, you know, you see, I think a lot of readers at The New York Times will read it in the morning because they're trying to get ready for the day. And they're trying to find out what happened overnight, all of these kinds of things. Whereas for The Atlantic, you know, so one, we don't have to cover the entire world. People don't come to us to find out what happened in the past 24 hours around the world. And so that is kind of freeing, but also kind of terrifying. And then that means that we have to have, as you kind of alluded to, a defined sense of what we do. So we have these thematic and geographic priorities. But then in terms of what an Atlantic story is as well, you know, we talk very deliberately about what is it we're trying to accomplish with an Atlantic story. So if it's just a summation of what's happened, that's not providing value or depth to our readers. And, you know, our sort of research with our readers suggests that what they want is, you know, to be challenged, to get more depth, more nuance. They don't want their existing biases confirmed. So we talk a lot about, you know, are we enriching a debate? Are we making a bold argument? Are we making a provocative argument? And not unnecessarily provocative and polemical, but, you know, trying to really further the cause of something in terms of furthering understanding. Are we, you know, making a reader kind of delighted with curiosity? Are we kind of picking up on something that is unusual about human behavior? I mean, these are the kinds of things we're often trying to, like, grapple with in our conversations. And then in terms of topics for the international section, you know, keeping the Atlantic is a values-driven, mission-driven organization in terms of how we think about our journalism. And so we do think very deeply about, you know, what is the future of liberal democracy? And then adjacent to that, how are populism, nationalism, authoritarianism developing? And then in terms of geographic priorities, you know, Britain is obviously interesting to us and important to us. One, because Brexit was such an epochal event before the coronavirus. But then beyond that, we think, you know, China and China's impact on the world is just, I mean, it's important is an understatement.
And are there still geographies you kind of, you want to explore and you want to go out to over the next few years?
We think about that, but I think the pandemic, you know, the business impacts of the pandemic are still being, we're so early in it that understanding that means that I think all of that is certainly a conversation for another day. So at the moment, what we're trying to do is sort of keep what we're doing working and making sure we're refining, one, our understanding of those stories that I described in terms of, you know, enriching arguments and this kind of thing, and seeing how we can kind of cover the pandemic internationally by getting into this idea of, you know, still most of our readers are in the United States. And so what can we learn from countries around the world? So, you know, as an example, we did a story, I want to say about a month or two ago, where one of our writers in Hong Kong worked with a writer who specializes in family and education topics. And they did kind of a roadmap for what happens to schooling and taking care of kids at the 2-week mark of a lockdown, at the, you know, 2-month mark of a lockdown, and then so on. And what can we learn? Because Hong Kong was much earlier in the pandemic than the United States was. So at the moment, at least, we're trying to sort of leverage the international reach we have to best understand this.
I definitely want to get onto your coronavirus coverage in a bit. But I've got one question from Peter, which I can't take credit for. But do you see your job as bringing the Atlantic to the rest of the world? Or are you more focused on bringing the rest of the world to the Atlantic?
Yes. Where, you know, I don't see that as an either or. I think both kind of, to some degree, build on the other, in the sense that, one, of course, you know, we want to reach new audiences, right? I think one of the things that's fascinating about the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, is their subscriber numbers in total are bigger than they ever have been, right? Because they've been able to reach audiences that just didn't have access to these fantastic news sources. And I think that's not dissimilar from, you know, the opportunity that we have, which is, I think when people come into contact with the Atlantic, they really do see a quality of writing, a quality of journalism that is over and above typically what they see at their home news organizations and elsewhere. And so I think there is value of bringing the Atlantic to the world, but then there is also, you know, an enriching kind of view. And it's not that the Atlantic has never covered international journalism, right? I mean, the Atlantic is a long tradition of international journalism. It's just we've never done it at this kind of cadence and with this, you know, deliberate kind of staffing people overseas and keeping people abroad. And so there is, you know, a value to that because Atlantic readers, I think, do want to understand how the world around them works. And, you know, it's almost cliche to say now, and the pandemic is such a great example of this, you know, great example is perhaps the wrong term, but how interconnected everything is. And so to sort of concentrate on just one country in terms of how news events and trends and developments play out is probably unnecessarily constraining. There needs to be a better understanding of how, you know, things work in China, how developments are happening in India, so we can help our readers and ourselves, you know, connect dots and make more interesting connections.
And part of making that kind of global coverage really good is about, I mean, a lot of people have cited, you know, you've got to have diverse viewpoints, you've got to have people that you wouldn't necessarily normally reach. So how, what does that look like in practice at the Atlantic in terms of making sure, have you got like a lot of diverse freelancers? What does your newsroom look like?
Yeah, that's such an important question. So one, I think intrinsically at the Atlantic, we've never been a place that has a house style or a house view. It's a very kind of debate-driven organization. We want arguments from different points of view, from different parts of the world. And that's something that we've always had. So there is, you know, a sort of respect and desire for diversity of viewpoints at the Atlantic. In terms of diversity of staffing and freelancers, you know, that is something that we do monitor and we do constantly sort of work to improve. I can, you know, there's a, I think it was a Neiman Lab story from a few months ago that talked about the promotion of our executive editor, Adrienne LaFrance, who's the first female executive editor at The Atlantic. And of course we can, you know, we should, you know, celebrate that. Adrienne is amazing at her job. But also I think there's a lot of concentration from Adrienne and from everyone at The Atlantic to really think deliberately about, you know, are we diverse at all of our levels and not just in a kind of, on one, in one facet, for example, not just to have gender diversity, but also to have ethnic diversity. And so one of the things we did, you know, last year in my section was we tracked all of our bylines and all of our sources. And we haven't been able to do that this year because we've, you know, the pandemic has kind of moved things around in terms of what we've been able to do in terms of free admin time, available admin time. And, you know, that is, you know, a shortcoming of my own, I'll admit. But I think the what we found was we were getting better at getting female bylines, but we were still over-indexing on male sources. And especially when you sort of really think about, you know, there was one example of a story we did about violence against women around the world. And in that situation, yeah, you know, the vast majority of sources were women. But, you know, it's also being kind of thoughtful and considered about the fact that it's not just having diversity of sources, but making sure that those sources are authoritative. So you're not just citing, you know, minorities or women in positions of vulnerability, but you're citing, you know, credible experts to, you know, really diversify who you're relying on for expertise. And that's, you know, not just important for us in terms of providing diversity, but it's also important from a reporting point of view, in that you want to have a diverse list of sources. If you're just talking to the same people over and over again, what are you gaining from that process?
Yeah, your role now is kind of as much more of an editor than a reporter. Do you miss the reporting side of it?
I really enjoyed reporting. I thought it was, you know, I've wanted to be a journalist my entire life. I wanted to be a reporter since I was like 12 years old. And so I think reporting is just a fantastic job. And I do miss it. But at the same time, you know, I think being an editor, it helps having been a reporter. I would like to think, of course, I would say that. But and then I also think, you know, these jobs kind of build on each other. So I'd like to think I'm a better editor for having been a reporter, particularly in, you know, stressful situations and having, I often think that, like, you know, some of my best editors were the kind of people when things were really kicking off. I lived in Baghdad for 5 years, and sometimes it was really gratifying when I used to call our headquarters and things were getting really tense. And the other end of the phone was just somebody who was incredibly calm and who was just saying, don't worry, we'll figure this out. And we're here to help. And I think I do miss it, but at the same time, I value the experience. And I think it's made me a better editor as a result.
Much calmer editor.
I hope so.
Okay, so onto the coronavirus stuff. You know, the coronavirus pandemic at the time we're recording broke, oh gosh, 7 weeks ago now. I don't know. I don't know what day it is now. What do those conversations look like when you're looking at global, not necessarily global coverage, but that global angle on coronavirus? Because governments are issuing all sorts of different advice, and nobody really knows what's going on. What does the approach look like, sort of internally, when you're looking to do these stories?
Yeah. So I think you touched on a couple of interesting points there. One is that you know, I think there's so many iterative developments that are happening, right? And it is overwhelming to a lot of people. And I think other news organizations have covered those developments incredibly well, and it's important that they do. But that is not really our space to say, you know, X thing has happened in the last few hours. As an example, though we have, you know, staff writers in Britain, the daily press conference in Britain is interesting and important, but we tend not to cover it as a news event. We tend to sort of mine it for ideas, for trends, for interesting developments that we want to kind of keep thinking about. So what we often do is, and the other thing you sort of talked about was that, you know, it's, there is an element of like, not just writing international stories, but thinking about international themes. And I think one of the things to I often think about is, you know, my section looks at international politics and international affairs, but, you know, I mean, leave aside the pandemic, a story about, you know, Facebook's data privacy practices, that's not an American story. That's an international global story that touches all of us. A story about, you know, Amazon in France and the restrictions against Amazon in France. That is not a French story. That is Amazon around the world. That is a labor rights story. And so thinking more broadly about how some of these themes and topics affect us, I think has been helpful. And so one of the things we do is we have really regular brainstorming sessions because the Atlantic, you know, I think I can come across, I can risk coming across as something of a broken record and sort of talking about our values and, you know, how we came about, but it is really important. We do talk about this a lot. We are an ideas-driven publication. And so it is really important. We have like lots of brainstorming meetings over Zoom. And we are constantly talking about what interests us. And then, you know, somebody will throw out an idea and then somebody else will be like, you know what, I've noticed that in this other way. And it becomes the germ of an idea for a story. And so much of it is, of course, you want brilliant people who are talented writers, but also you want to kind of put them in a room together so that they can bounce off each other. And so we do that a lot. We're trying to constantly think of, you know, new ways and not be just beholden to the news cycle because, you know, as I said earlier, I think it would be very easy for us to fall back on that, but that's not what readers want from us.
Yeah, it's easy to get sucked into that.
Exactly. And there's so much news about the coronavirus and, you know, we're just not the kind of news organization. We're not big enough. And I don't think that's what readers want from us.
And actually, I know The Atlantic, it's made headlines early this month in Neiman Lab and things for you've actually had a huge surge in digital subscriptions despite lifting the paywall on that coverage. Do you think there's a single reason for that? Like, are you bringing new people to the journalism or is it a bit more complicated?
So I think it can be both of those things to some degree. So, you know, first off, I think one of the things we've seen and I think other news organizations have seen is readers want a credible source of news and they're looking for credible sources of information. So we have, you know, we're really grateful that we benefit from that and also grateful that these people are paying for us. That's amazing. I think there are a couple things that seem to be happening. One is, yes, I think people come to The Atlantic and they read, for example, Ed Yong on science and they're just blown away because he is, you know, just such a high quality writer and reporter and somebody who synthesizes such complex things. And he's such a great communicator. But then if it was just Ed, I think a lot of those readers would just come for Ed and leave and they wouldn't hit the five story kind of metered limit. And so much of it is having a momentum and a cadence and then a large collection of talented writers who are bringing different things to the table so that after you read Ed Yong, you see, you know, there's a fantastic piece by you know, Helen Lewis, or you see another piece by Amanda Mall or Caitlin Tiffany. And these are all, you know, amazing writers of ours who write about different topics from technology to culture to science to politics. And building up, you know, using that collection of writers to help readers build up something of a habit so that they come to us more than once, more than twice. And then also, you know, I think lots of news organizations are doing this. I don't think we're far from alone in this, but it's not just about the writing. It's about bringing readers in and sort of helping them understand The Atlantic and the quality of work we do in multiple ways. So, you know, we've had two podcasts for a long time, Crazy Genius and The Ticket, which is, you know, Crazy Genius is about technology and its impact on society. And The Ticket is about politics, mostly American politics. But then, you know, earlier this year, we had, you know, our first episodic feature podcast, which is about the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, floodlines. And then because of the coronavirus, we spun up a new one called Social Distance. And I think, you know, that has really helped us interact with readers in a lot of different ways. You know, the New York Times, again, often says this about The Daily, and we found this as well, is introducing people to our writers beyond just the writing provides another level of connection. And then finally, you know, I think the fact the coronavirus has forced us to put a lot of our events online, and that has also provided just a different venue for readers to interact with us, with our readers, with our journalists. And so all of those things in tandem, I think, do help build that habit and that connection to The Atlantic. So when they do subscribe, they feel like they're not just, you know, logging onto The Atlantic every so often. They're interacting with us, you know, through newsletters, through podcasts, through live events. And that provides something more of a holistic connection.
Yeah. There was something you said in there was a Reuters webinar you were part of about you said you saw The Atlantic as a second subscription for global audiences. Can you explain a little bit what you mean about that? Because I thought that was really interesting.
Sure. So we need to define competition, right? When we think about who we are and where we are in the landscape. Yeah. So in a very broad sense, we're competing with everybody, right? Like if you're reading us on your cell phone and you get a notification from like Netflix, then we're competing with Netflix in that moment to hold your attention. We're competing with Candy Crush. We're competing with any number of different things that are, you know, as people read more and more on mobile.
You see Candy Crush as competition.
Well, I mean, if you see what I mean, it's like anything that provides a notification on a cell phone is competing with what you're reading for attention.
Okay.
And so that means that we have to be at least conscious of the fact that readers have multiple demands on their time and their attention, and they're perhaps not reading us in the way that they used to read The Atlantic or a newspaper, right? They're not reading us in one fell swoop with no distractions. Like the equivalent would be if you're reading The Atlantic and you had the TV and the radio on at the same time, which, you know, very few people I imagine used to do. And so we have that breadth of competition, but then in the narrow sense, if we think of just, you know, journalistic organizations, we have to, you know, understand what we are providing to readers. And certainly in our research, we found that, you know, readers don't read us to catch up on what happened last night, overnight. You know, they don't read us to see, you know, to hear what just happened in the Trump press conference or the, you know, the Daily British press conference. They're reading us for depth, for nuance, for context. And so, you know, it's not surprising to us that, you know, for example, the BBC is not a subscription, but obviously, you know, people, you know, pay through the license fee, or The Guardian in Britain, that they read, you know, those news organizations first before they come to us. So then we need to be honest about what it is we're providing, in that sense, that we are, you know, not going to be a provider of news in the kind of daily news sense, which then also kind of feeds into how we should perceive ourselves and what kind of services we provide to readers.
Talking of coronavirus and coverage, I think you're actually getting your running shoes on for journalists in September. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So one of the things I really sort of I think about a lot is I've been a journalist for like 15 years now, professional journalist for 15 years. And so I've been very lucky to work for staff news organizations my entire life. And, you know, staff news organizations can be befuddling and frustrating in, you know, 100 different ways. But there are, you know, a couple huge benefits, one of which I get my salary at the end of every month. And then, you know, I've worked in some pretty like sort of sketchy places, and each of like those places where I've worked, I've had, you know, access to security resources. I've had access to any number of different resources that mean that I can just concentrate on the work, and I don't need to worry as much about, you know, some of the security implications of, you know, working in a place like Baghdad. And so this pandemic is, you know, we often say it's almost cliche to say now, but it's kind of revealed a lot of inequities in the system, and it's revealed a lot of fragility in the system. And there's so many freelancers who are struggling at the moment, or so many people who've been laid off. And so I'm running a marathon. I'm running the Brighton Marathon in September, the delayed Brighton Marathon in September, for the Rory Peck Trust, which, you know, supports and trains and advocates for freelance journalists around the world with emergency grants and supports for families. They've got a COVID hardship fund at the moment for people who need just small bits of money to make it through the month. You know, one of the things we do try to do at The Atlantic is, you know, you'll see it in all of our job adverts. We advocate a spirit of generosity. Again, I risk coming across as ridiculously earnest with all of this stuff, but, you know, this is actually something we do advocate internally, is a spirit of generosity, a belief that, you know, we serve a greater purpose, and we have to sort of think beyond just winning subscribers and getting readers. Yeah. We need to be doing something bigger for society. And so this is part of that. So it's my pinned tweet on Twitter. And if you go to justgiving.com/fundraising/PrashantRuns, you'll get to my page. So any donations would be hugely appreciated. But also, even if you could just share it, if any of your readers share it, that would be also just like fantastic.
Yeah, we'll include a link in our show notes.
Thank you.
And then the last thing we ask all our guests is, what's the last thing you saw, read, watched, or listened to that really affected you?
So I've been, you know, like everyone else, trying desperately not to read about the coronavirus in my downtime. And so one thing that I've really enjoyed doing is when I was a kid and growing up, I used to really love reading Calvin and Hobbes, the comic strip. and I have all of the Calvin and Hobbes books. So I've been diving back into those, and I'm basically making my way through what I think is the greatest comic strip of the 1980s and 1990s. That's kind of nerdy, but it also takes me away. It's fun, it's sweet, it's political, and it just, it gives me something to read before I go to bed at night that is just kind of heartwarming.
So that little fanfare was for the Media Roundup, which is our first daily newsletter, and the first issue is gone today. So if you want to get that, you can sign up on our website at voices.media. So our whole aim for this is that we want to be succinct and valuable, and we want to be starting the day with you with the top 3 to 4 stories you need to know each day that will make a difference to you and the industry. So yeah, please sign up at voices.media.
Sign up, people, because we want to start the day with you.
Yeah, I was going to say, the way you said it, it was like they were all over and we were just next to them in bed.
Wake up with Media Voices.
That'd be creepy. Also, we're releasing the latest in a series of case studies into the winning podcast from the first ever Publisher Podcast Awards earlier this year. Check out what Dave Musgrove from Immediate Media said about making the History Extra podcast so brilliant on the website voices.media, where you can also see case studies on Empire from Terry White and Ben Thompson from Nature. Have a look. Good stuff. More coming soon, actually.
Don't forget that while you're on our website, which is voices.media, you can check out our entire archive of back episodes, which, Peter, you mentioned it when you did your talk at PPA the other day. Are we on 134?
141 this week.
Don't forget that you can also keep abreast of everything that we're doing during the week by going to our social channels. Probably the primary one is Twitter. Go to @MediaVoicesPod to stay abreast of everything that we're doing. And periodically we'll link out from there to our own social channels as well. But until next week, when we're going to be back with another fantastic guest, probably some more plugs for our new daily newsletter, and another look through all the news and views from the media world. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and goodbye.
Bye.
Get the daily.